up on the address for Flex, the yoga studio owned by Roberts. He slowed the car to a crawl as we passed by the storefront studio. I checked the hours printed on the door and saw the place was open 8 to 8 every day. I could see people inside, all women and all in downward dog positions on rubber mats on the floor. I knew the position because my ex-wife was a longtime yoga enthusiast. I wondered if Robert's clients minded being on display to the street and passers-by on the sidewalk. Many of the positions in yoga have a subtle or overt sexuality to them, and it seemed odd to have a studio where one wall was floor-to-ceiling glass. As I pondered the question, a woman inside the studio walked up to the window and held her hands up to her eyes, pantomiming that she was looking at me through binoculars. The point was clear. "We can go now, Earl," I said. He picked up speed. "Where to?" "Let's go down the road a bit to Art's Deli. We'll pick up sandwiches, and then I'll go see Legal Siegel for lunch." Chapter 15. At 8:30 that night, I knocked on the door at Kendall Roberts' home. I had been sitting out in the Lincoln on her street and waiting for her to return.
"Mr. Holler, is something wrong?"
She was wearing the same outfit from earlier, and I assumed she had come from work at the yoga studio.
"No, nothing is wrong. I just came back to tell you that you can forget about that subpoena."
"What do you mean? Did you take it to a judge like you said?"
"Didn't need to. I noticed after I left here that there wasn't a seal on it from the clerk of the U.S. District Court. Moya's case is in federal court. Gotta have that seal or it's not legit. I think the lawyer, Falcone, was trying to see if he could get you to come in on the sly, so he doctored up what looked like a subpoena and had his man take it out to you."
"Why would he do that? I mean, want me to come in on the sly?"
I had already been puzzling over this, especially since the subpoena Falcone had dropped on me had been legit. Why go through the correct motions on mine and not Kendall's? So far, I hadn't been able to figure out why.
"Good question," I said. "If he wanted to keep it quiet, he could have filed the subpoena request under seal, but he didn't. Instead, he tried to bluff you into coming in for an interview. I'm probably going to see him tomorrow, and that's exactly what I'll ask."
"Well, it's all confusing, but thank you."
Confusion aside, we aim to please at Michael Holler and Associates. I smiled, and then felt dumb about what I had just said.
"You know, you could have called me. I gave you my number. You didn't have to come all the way back out here."
I frowned and shook my head like her concern was warrantless. "It was no problem. My daughter lives nearby with my ex, and I swung by there for a bit." It wasn't exactly a lie. I had indeed driven by my ex-wife's condo building and stared at the lighted windows of her unit. I imagined my daughter in there in her bedroom, doing her homework or on the computer tweeting or Facebooking with friends. I had then driven over to see Kendall Roberts.
"So that means that next Tuesday I don't have to go to that lawyer's office?"
she asked. "No, you're clear," I said. "You can forget about it."
"And I won't have to go to court or testify about anything?"
That was the big question, and I knew I had to stop making promises I was not sure I could keep. "What I'm going to do is see Falcone tomorrow and make it clear to him that you're out of it, that you have no knowledge that will be useful to him in this matter, and he should forget about you. I think that should take care of it."
"Thank you."
"Anytime." I didn't make a move to leave, and she glanced over my shoulder toward the street where my car was parked again in the red zone.
"So where's your partner, the mean one?"
I started to laugh. "Oh, Earl? He's off now. He's actually my driver. Sorry again about that today. I didn't know what I was getting into when we came here."
"You're forgiven?"
I nodded. There was nothing else to say at that point, but I still didn't move from my position on the front doorstep. The silence became awkward, and she finally broke it.
"Is there..."
"Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just standing here like a goof or something."
"It's okay."
"No,
You know, the real reason I came back is I wanted to talk about that question you asked. I mean, from earlier today.
What question?
She leaned against the doorframe. You asked me about the past, you know? About how I lived with the past, my past.
She nodded. She remembered now.
I'm sorry, she said. I was being sarcastic, and that was out of line. I had no business.
No, it's fine.
Sarcasm or not, the question was valid. But then that guy knocked on the door with the phony subpoena, and I, you know, never answered the question.
So you came back to answer it?
I smiled uneasily.
Well, sort of.
I thought that the past for both of us was something. I started laughing with embarrassment and shook my head. Actually, I don't know what I'm saying here.
Would you like to come in, Mr. Holler?
I would love to, but you have to stop calling me that. Call me Michael or Mickey or Mick. You know, Gloria used to call me Mickey Mantle.
She held the door wide, and I stepped into the entry area.
I've also been called Mickey Mouth on occasion. You know, because lawyers are sometimes called mouthpieces.
Yes, I get it.
I was about to have a glass of red wine. Would you like one?
I almost asked if she had something stronger, but thought better of it.
That would be perfect.
She closed the door and we went into the kitchen to get glasses and pour the wine. She handed me a glass and then took up her own. She leaned against the counter and looked at me.
Cheers, I said.
Cheers, she said. Can I ask you something?
Sure.
You're coming here? This isn't some sort of thing you have, is it?
What do you mean? What thing?
You know, with women. Like me. I'm retired. I don't do it anymore. And if you went through this whole damsel in distress thing with a subpoena because you thought,
no, not at all. Look, I'm sorry. This is embarrassing and I should probably just go. I put my glass on the counter. You're right, I said. I should have just called. I was halfway to the hallway when she stopped me.
Wait, Mickey.
I looked back at her.
I didn't say you should have just called. I said you could have just called. There's a difference.
She took my glass off the counter and brought it to me.
I'm sorry, she said. I needed to get that out of the way. You'd be surprised how my former life still affects my current one.
I nodded. I get it.
Let's go sit down.
We went into the living room and took the same seats we sat in earlier in the day, across from each other, a coffee table between us. The conversation was stilted at first. We exchanged banal pleasantries, and I complimented the wine like the expert enophile I was not. I finally asked her how she ended up with a yoga studio, and she matter-of-factly explained that a former client from her escort days had loaned her the initial investment. It reminded me of my attempt to help Gloria Dayton, but obviously with different results.
I think for some of the girls, they really don't want to get out, Kendall said. They get what they need from it, on a lot of levels. So they may talk about wanting out, but they never do it. I got lucky. I wanted out, and there was someone there to help me. How'd you end up being a lawyer?
She had expertly, if not abruptly, thrown the lead back to me, and I responded with the basic explanation about following a family tradition. When I told her my father had been Mickey Cohen's attorney, her eyes showed no recognition.
Way before your time, I said. He was a gangster out here in the 40s and 50s. Pretty famous. There's been movies about him. He was part of what they called the Jewish Mafia, with Bugsy Siegel.
Another name that did not register with her.
Your father must have had you late in life if he was running around with those guys in the 40s.
I nodded. I was the kid from the second marriage. I think I was a surprise.
Young wife?
I nodded again, and wished the conversation were going in a different direction. I had sorted all of this out for myself before. I had checked the county records. My father divorced his first wife and married his second less than 2 months later. I came 5 months after that. It didn't take a law degree to connect the dots. I was told as a child that my mother had come from Mexico, where she was a famous actress, but I never saw a movie poster, a newspaper clipping, or a publicity still anywhere in the house. I have a half-brother who's an LAPD cop, I said. He's older. He works homicide. I didn't know why I said it. I guess to change directions.
Same father?
Yeah.
Do you guys get along?
Yeah, to a point. We never knew about each other until a few years ago. So consequently, I guess we're not that close.
Isn't it funny that you didn't know about each other and you became a defense lawyer and he became a cop?
Yeah, I guess. Funny. I was desperate to get off the path we were on, but couldn't think of a topic that would do it. Kendall rescued me with a question that broke new ground, but was equally painful to answer.
You mentioned your ex, so you're not married?
No. I was. Twice, actually. But the second one, I don't really count. It was quick and painless. We both knew it was a mistake and we're still friends. In fact, she works for me.
But the first one?
We have a daughter. She nodded, seemingly understanding the lifelong complications and connections a broken marriage with a child produces.
And your daughter's mother, are you on good terms?
I sadly shook my head. No, not anymore. Actually, I'm not on good terms with either of them at the moment.
I'm sorry.
Me too. I took another drink of wine and studied her.
What about you?
I asked.
People like me don't have long relationships.
I got married when I was 20. It lasted a year. No kids, thank God. Do you know where he is, your ex? I mean, do you keep track of each other? My ex and me, we're in the same business. The law, so I see her in the courthouse every now and then. If she sees me coming in the hall, she usually goes the other way. She nodded, but I didn't detect any sympathy.
Last time I heard from my ex, he wrote me a letter from a prison in Pennsylvania, she said. He wanted me to sell my car so I could send him money each month. I didn't reply, and that was about 10 years ago. He's still there for all I know.
Wow, and here I was all woe is me because my ex-wife turns away from me in the courthouse. I think you win. I hoisted my glass to toast her, and she nodded in acceptance of the win.
So why are you really here? She asked. Are you hoping that I can tell you more about Glory?
I looked down at my glass, which was now almost empty. This was either going to be the end of things or the start. You'd tell me, right, if there was something I needed to know about her? She frowned.
I told you all I know.
Then I believe you. I finished my wine and put the glass on the table. Thanks for the wine, Kendall. I should probably go now. She walked me to the front door and held it open for me. I touched her arm as I passed by. I tried to think of something to say that would leave us with the possibility of another meeting. She beat me to it.
Maybe next time you come back, you'll be more interested in me than the dead girl.
I looked back at her as she closed the door. I nodded, but she was gone. Chapter 16. I was trying to talk a final shot of Patron out of Randy after last call at Four Green Fields, when my phone screen lit up on the bar top. It was Cisco, and he was working late.
Cisco. Sorry if I woke you, Mick, but I thought you'd want me to.
No worries. What's up?
Randy hit the bright lights and started blasting Closing Time on the sound system, hoping to chase the lingering drinkers out.
I hit the mute button late and slid off the stool to head to the door.
What the hell was that? Cisco asked. Mick, you there?
Once I was out the door, I took the phone off mute.
Sorry, iPhone malfunction. Where are you and what's going on?
I'm outside the Standard downtown. Trina Trix is inside doing what she does. But that's not why I called. That could have waited. I wanted to ask how he had found Trina, but noted the urgency in his voice.
Okay, so then what couldn't wait?
I muted the phone again and got in my car, pulling the door closed behind me. It had been a stupid move chasing the wine I had shared with Kendall with tequila, but I had felt bad after leaving her place, as though I had fumbled the ball somehow, and I wanted to burn away the thoughts with Patron. "I just got a call from a guy who does me favors every now and then," Sisko said. "You know the Ferrari dealership I told you about before?"
"Yeah, the one on Wilshire."
"Right. Well, I hit the gold mine there. A lot of video. They keep digital film for a year on the cloud. So we got double lucky."
"Did you see the man in the hat's face?"
"No, not that lucky. Still no face. But we went through the video on the night in question, and I picked up Gloria and her driver going by. Then, four cars back comes a Mustang, and it looks like our guy. He's still wearing the hat, so I'm 90% sure he's our guy."
"Okay." "One of their perimeter cameras shoots east along the front of the lot. I switch to that video and check out the Mustang."
"You got a plate."
"Damn right I got a plate.
So I gave it to this friend of mine, and he just called me back after going into work tonight." By friend, I knew he meant that he had a source in the cop shop who ran plates for him. A source who obviously worked the midnight shift. This practice of sharing information from the computer with an outsider was against the law in California, so I didn't ask Sisko for any clarification on who provided the information that he was about to share. I just waited for him to tell me the name. "All right, so the sting comes back to a guy named Lee Lankford. And get this, Mick, he's law enforcement. My friend can tell because his address is not on the computer. They protect cops that way. They can put a law enforcement block on the registration of a personal vehicle, but he's L.E., and now we have to find out who he works for and why he was tailing Gloria. I already know this. He's not LAPD. My friend checked. Bottom line, Mick, is I'm beginning to think there might be something to our clients claiming he was set up." I didn't hear most of what Sisko had said after he mentioned the Mustang owner's name. I was off to the races, running with the name Lankford. Sisko hadn't recognized it, because he wasn't working for me 8 years before, when I made the deal whereby Gloria Dayton gave up Hector Moya to the DA's office, which turned around and gave him up to the feds. Of course, back then, Lankford had nothing to do with that deal, but he was skirting around that case like a vulture. "Lankford is Glendale PD retired," I said. "He's currently working for the DA as an investigator."
"You know him?"
"Sort of. He worked the murder of Raoul Levin. In fact, he's the guy who tried at first to pin it on me, and I saw him on this case at La Casa's first appearance. He's the DA investigator assigned to the case." I heard Sisko whistle as I started the car.
"So let's talk this out," he said. "We have Lankford following Gloria Dayton on the night she was murdered. He presumably follows her home, and about an hour later she is murdered in her apartment.
And then a couple days later at first appearance he's there," I said. "He's assigned to the Dayton murder case."
"That's not a coincidence, Mick. There are no coincidences like that."
I nodded, even though I was alone in the car.
"It's a setup," I said. "Andre's been telling the truth."
I needed to get to my Gloria Dayton files, but Jennifer Aronson still had them. It would have to wait until the morning staff meeting. In the meantime, I was trying to remember those days 8 years ago, when I first met Detective Lankford and became his prime suspect in the murder of my own investigator. I suddenly remembered what Sisko had said at the top of the conversation. "You're tailing Trina Trix right now?"
"Yeah, she wasn't hard to find. I drove by her place to get a feel for it, and out she came. I followed her here. Same setup that Gloria had. The driver, the whole bit. She's been inside the hotel for about 40 minutes now."
"Okay, I'm heading your way. I want to talk to her tonight."
"I'll make that happen."
"You okay to drive? You sound like you had a few."
"I'm fine. I'll grab coffee on the way. You just hold her until I get there."
Chapter 17. Before I got to the Standard downtown, I got a text from Sisko redirecting me to an address and apartment number on Spring Street.
Then I got another text, this one advising me to hit an ATM on the way. Trina wanted to be paid to talk. When I finally got to the address, it turned out it was one of the rehabbed lofts right behind the police administration building. The lobby door was locked, and when I buzzed apartment 12C, it was my own investigator who answered and buzzed me up. On the 12th floor, I stepped out of the elevator to find Cisco waiting in the open doorway of 12C. I followed her home from the Standard and waited until she was dropped off, he explained. Figured it'd be easier if we took her driver out of the equation. I nodded and looked through the open door but didn't enter. Is she going to talk to us? Depends on how much cash you brought. She's a businesswoman through and through. I got enough. I walked past him and into a loft with views over the PAB and the Civic Center. The City Hall tower lit up and on center display. The apartment was a nice place, though sparely furnished. Trina Rafferty had either recently moved in or was in the process of moving out. She was sitting on a white leather couch with chrome feet. She wore a short black cocktail dress, had her legs crossed in a stab at modesty, and was smoking a cigarette. "Are you going to pay me?" she asked. I walked fully into the room and looked down at her. She was pushing 40 and she looked tired. Her hair was slightly disheveled, her lipstick was smeared, and her eyeliner was caking at the corners. One more long night in another year of long nights. She had just come from having sex with someone she didn't know before and would probably never see again. "It depends on what you tell me."
"Well, I'm not telling you anything unless you pay up front."
I had hit an ATM in the Bonaventure Hotel lobby and made two maximum withdrawals of $400 each. The money had come in hundreds, fifties, and twenties, and I split it between two pockets. I took out the first $400 and dropped it on her coffee table next to the crowded ashtray. "There's $400. Is that good enough to start?" She picked up the money, folded it twice, and worked it into one of her high-heeled shoes. I remembered in that moment that Gloria had once told me that she always put her cash payments into her shoes, because the shoes were usually the last thing to come off, if at all. Many clients liked her to keep her heels on while they had sex.
"We'll see," Trina said. "Ask away."
The whole drive downtown, I had considered what I should ask and how I should ask it. I had a feeling this might be my only shot with Trina Trix. Once Team Falgoni found out I had gotten to her, they would attempt to shut down my access. "Tell me about James Marco and Hector Moya." Her body rocked backward with surprise, and then straightened up. She stuck out her lower lip for a few seconds before responding.
"I didn't realize that this is about them. You need to pay me more if you want to talk about them."
Without hesitation, I took the other fold of money out of my pocket and dropped it on the table. It disappeared into her other shoe. I sat down on an ottoman directly across the table from her. "Let's hear it," I said.
"Marco's a DEA agent, and he had a hard-on for Hector," she said. "He really wanted to get him, and he did."
"How did you know Marco?"
"He busted me."
"When?"
"It was a sting. He posed as a John and he wanted sex and coke and I brought both. Then I got busted."
"When was this?"
"About 10 years ago. I don't remember the dates."
"You made a deal with him?"
"Yeah, he let me go, but I had to tell him stuff. He'd call me."
"What stuff?"
"Just stuff I would hear or know about, you know, from clients. He agreed to let me go if I fed him. And he was always hungry."
"Hungry for Hector?"
"Well, no, he didn't know about Hector, at least not from me. I wasn't that stupid or that desperate. I'd take the bust before I'd give up Hector. The guy was cartel, you know what I mean? So I gave Marco the little stuff, the kind of stuff guys would brag about while fucking. All their big scores and plans and whatever. Guys try to compensate with talk all the time, you know?"
I nodded, though I didn't know if I was revealing something about myself by agreeing. I tried to stay on track with what she was saying, and how it fit with the latest permutation of Gloria's case.
Okay, I said. So you didn't give up Hector to Marco.
Who did?
I knew that indirectly, at least, Gloria Dayton had given Moya up, but I didn't know what Trina knew.
All I can tell you is that it wasn't me, Trina said.
I shook my head. It's not good enough, Trina. Not for $800.
What, you want me to throw in a blowjob, too? That's not a problem.
No, I want you to tell me everything. I want you to tell me what you told Sly Falcone. She went through the same body shiver as when I had first mentioned Hector Moya, as though for a second she had been shocked by the name and then was able to reconstitute herself.
How do you know about Sly?
Because I do. And if you want to keep the money, I need to know what you told him.
But isn't that like attorney-client stuff? Like it's privileged or whatever they call it?
I shook my head. You've got it wrong, Trina. You're a witness, not a client. Falcone's client is Hector Moya. What did you tell him? I leaned forward on the ottoman as I said it, and then I waited.
Well, I told him about another girl who Marco busted and was putting to work. Like me, only he really had her under his thumb. I don't know why. I think when he caught her, she had a lot more on her than I had.
You mean a lot more cocaine?
Right, and her record wasn't as clean as mine. She was going to go down hard if she didn't come up with something bigger than herself. You know what I mean?
Yes. It was how most drug cases were built. Small fish giving up bigger fish. I nodded as though I had full knowledge about how things worked, but once again I was privately humiliated because I had not even known the details of my own client's dealings with the DEA. Trina was obviously talking about Gloria Dayton, and she was telling a story I didn't know. So your friend gave up Hector, I said, hoping to keep the story moving so I didn't have to dwell on my own failings in the case.
Sort of.
What do you mean, sort of? She did or she didn't?
She sort of did. She told me that Marco made her hide a gun in Moya's hotel room so that when they busted him, they could add charges and send him away for life. See, Hector was smart. He never kept enough in his room for them to make a big case on, just a few ounces, sometimes less. But the gun charge would change everything, and Glory was the one who brought it in. She said when Hector fell asleep after she did him, she took it out of her purse and hid it under the mattress.
To say I was stunned was an understatement. In the course of the past several months, I had already accepted the fact that I'd been used by Gloria in some way. But if Trina Rafferty's story was true, the level of deception and manipulation was as masterful as it was perfect, and I had played my part to a T, thinking I was carrying out good lawyering by pulling all the right strings for my client, when all along it was my client and her DEA handler who held the strings. My strings. I still had many questions about the scenario Trina was outlining, mainly the question of why I was even needed in the scheme. But for the moment, I was thinking of other things. The only way this knowledge could be more humiliating would be for it to become public, and everything the prostitute sitting in front of me was saying indicated that this was exactly the direction it was going. I tried not to show any of the internal meltdown I was feeling. I kept my voice steady and asked the next question. When you say Glory, I take it you mean Gloria Dayton, also known at that time as Glory Days? Before she could answer, the iPhone on the coffee table started vibrating. Trina eagerly snatched it up, probably hoping she could get in one last booking before crashing for the night. She checked the ID, but it was blocked. She answered anyway.
Hello, this is Trina Trix.
While she listened to the caller, I glanced at Cisco to see what I could read in his face. I wondered if he understood from what had been said that I had been an unwitting participant in a rogue DEA agent's scheme.
And another man, Trina told her caller. He said you're not my lawyer.
I looked at Trina. She wasn't talking to a potential customer. Is that Falcone? I said. Let me talk to him. She hesitated,
but then told the caller to hold on and handed me the phone.
Falcone, I said. I thought you were going to call me back.
There was a pause, and then a voice I didn't recognize as Sly Falcone Jr. spoke.
I didn't know I was supposed to.
And then I realized I was talking to Sly Sr., person to person from FCI Victorville. He was probably on a cell phone smuggled into the lockup by a visitor or a guard. Many of my incarcerated clients were able to communicate with me on burners, throwaway phones with limited minutes and lifespans.
Your son was supposed to get back to me. How are things up there, Sly? Not too bad. I'm out of here in another 11 months.
How did you know I was here?
I didn't. I was checking on Trina.
I didn't believe that for a moment. It sounded like he had specifically asked Trina about me before she passed the phone over. I decided not to push it. Yet.
What can I do for you, Mr. Holler?
Well, I'm sitting here talking to Trina, and I'm wondering what I'm going to be doing for you. I got the subpoena, and I'm just beginning to put together the angle you're playing for Moya. And I gotta tell you, I have a problem being made to look like a fool, especially in open court.
That is understandable. But sometimes, when one has indeed played the fool, it is difficult to skirt the issue. You have to be prepared for the truth to come out. A man's freedom is at stake.
I'll keep that in mind. I disconnected and handed the phone back across the table to Trina.
What did he say?
She asked. Nothing much at all. How much have they promised you?
What?
Come on, Trina. You're a businesswoman. You charge me just to answer a few questions here. You must be charging something to tell that story in a depot for a judge. How much? Did they already take your statement?
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't been paid anything.
What about this place? They get you this to keep you close?
No, this is my place, and I want you to leave. Both of you. Get out, now.
I glanced at Cisco. I could push it, but it was pretty clear that my 800 bucks were spent, and she was finished talking. Whatever Falcone had said before the phone was handed to me had frozen her. It was time to go. I stood up and nodded Cisco toward the door. Thanks for your time, I said to Trina. I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Don't count on it.
We left the apartment and had to wait for the elevator. I stepped back to Trina's door and bent forward to listen. I thought she'd make a call to someone, maybe Sly Jr., but I heard nothing. The elevator came and we rode down. Cisco was quiet. What's up, big man? I asked.
Nothing, just thinking.
How did he know to call her then?
I nodded. It was a good question. I hadn't thought it through yet.
We left the building and walked out onto Spring Street, which was deserted except for a couple of empty patrol cars parked along the side of the PAB. It was after 2 a.m., and there was no sign of another human being anywhere.
You think I was followed?
I asked. Cisco thought about it for a moment before nodding. Somehow, he knew we'd found her, that we were with her.
That's not good.
I'll get your car checked tomorrow, and then put a couple Indians on you. If you have a physical tail, we'll know it soon enough. The associates Cisco used in counter-surveillance were so adept at disappearing into the crevices that he called them Indians, after the old westerns in which the Indians used to trail the wagon trains without the white settlers even knowing they were there.
That will be good, I said. Thanks.
Where'd you park? Cisco asked. Up in front of the PAB. Figured it was safe. You?
I'm around back here.
You okay or you want an escort?
I'm good. See you at the staff meeting.
I'll be there. We headed off in different directions. I looked over my shoulder three times before I made it to my car, parked in the safest spot in downtown. From there, I kept an eye on the rearview mirror all the way home. Chapter 18. I was the last to arrive at the loft for the staff meeting, and I was dragging.
I'd hit the private stash of Patron Silver when I'd finally gotten home just a few hours before. Between the alcohol consumption, the trip downtown to interview Trina Rafferty, and the disquiet that comes with the knowledge that you were probably being watched, I'd gotten only a couple hours of restless sleep before the alarm sounded. I grunted a hello to the assemblage in the boardroom and went immediately to the coffee setup on the side counter. I poured half a cup, shot two Advils into my mouth, and took the scalding hot liquid down in one gulp. I then refilled and this time added milk and sugar to make it a little more palatable. That first blast had burned my throat, but it helped me find my voice. How's everybody today? Better than me, I hope. Everyone chimed in positively. I turned to find a seat and immediately noticed that Earl was at the table. For a moment I forgot why, and then remembered that I had indeed invited him to join the inner circle the day before. Oh, everybody, I invited Earl to join us. He's going to take a more active role in some of the work, from the standpoint of investigations and interviews. He'll still be driving the Lincoln, but he's got other skills, and I intend to exploit them to the benefit of our clients. I nodded to Earl, and as I did so, I realized I had not mentioned his elevation to Sisko. Still, Sisko showed no surprise, and I realized I had obviously been helped out there by Lorna, who had kept her husband informed where I had failed. I pulled out a chair at the end of the table and sat down, noticing the small black electronic device with three green blinking lights at the center of the table.
Mickey, you don't want a donut? Lorna asked. It looks like you should put something in your stomach.
No, not right now, I said.
What is that?
I pointed at the device. It was a rectangular black box about the size of an iPhone, only an inch thick, and it had three separate stub antennas sticking out of one end. Sisko answered. I was just telling everyone. That's a Paquin 7000 blocker. Stops all transmissions by Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and radio wave. No one will hear what we say in this room outside of these walls.
Did you find a bug?
With one of these things, you don't even have to look. That's the beauty of it.
What about the Lincoln?
I have some guys looking at it out back right now. They were waiting for you to arrive. I'll let you know as soon as I know. I reached into my pocket for the keys. They don't need your keys, Sisko said. Of course not, I realized. They're pros. I took the keys out anyway, put them on the table, and slid them down to Earl. He'd be driving the rest of the day. Okay, well, let's get started. I'm sorry I'm late. Long night. I know that's not an excuse, but... I braced myself with another slug of coffee, and this time it went down easier, and I began to feel it take hold of my bloodstream. I looked at the faces around the table and got down to it. Pointing to the Paquin 7000, I said, "Sorry for all the secret agent stuff, but I think precautions are necessary. We had some significant developments yesterday and last night, and I wanted everybody to be here and to be made aware of what's happening." As if to underline the seriousness of my opening statement, a power cord from an electric guitar echoed through the ceiling and stopped me cold. All of us looked up at the ceiling. It had sounded like the opening chord tab of A Hard Day's Night. The coincidence was not lost on me.
"I thought the Beatles were broken up," I said.
"They are," Lorna said, "and we were promised no band practice in the mornings."
Another chord was strummed, and then followed by some improvisational noodling. Somebody pumped a hi-hat on a drum kit, and the clash of cymbals almost loosened my fillings.
"You've got to be kidding me," I said.
"Shouldn't those guys be hung over or asleep? I know I wish I was still in bed."
"I'll go up," Lorna said. "This makes me really angry."
"No, Sisko, you go up. You already know the update. I want Lorna to hear it, and you might get better results up there." "On it." Sisko left the room and headed upstairs. It was one of the few times I was pleased that he had worn a t-shirt to work, exposing his impressive biceps and intimidating tattoos. The t-shirt celebrated the 110th anniversary of Harley-Davidson motorcycles. I thought that might help get the message across as well.
To the rhythm of a bass drum from above, I began updating the others, starting with the subpoena Valenzuela laid on me the morning before, and then moving through the happenings of the rest of the day. About halfway through, a terrific crash was heard from above, as Sisko put an end to band practice. I finished my story by recounting the late-night meeting with Trina Trix, and the conclusion prompted by Fulgoni's call from prison that I was under surveillance. Nobody asked any questions along the way, though Jennifer took some notes. I didn't know if the silence was a testament to the early hour, the implied threat that surveillance meant to all of us, or my fully engaging skill as a storyteller. There was also the possibility that I had simply lost everyone on one of the turns of the convoluted tale I was spinning. Sisko re-entered the room, looking none the worse for wear. He took his seat and nodded to me. Problem solved. I looked at the others. Questions? Jennifer raised her pen as though she were still in school.
I actually have a few, she said. First of all, you said that Sylvester Fulgoni Sr. called you from the prison in Victorville at 2 a.m. How is that possible? I don't think they give inmates access to...
They don't, I said. The number was blocked, but I'm sure it was a cell phone, smuggled into him or given to him by a guard.
Couldn't that be traced?
Not really, not if it was a burner.
A burner?
A throwaway phone, bought with no names attached. Look, we're getting off the subject here. Suffice it to say it was Fulgoni and he called me from prison, where someone had obviously reached out to him to inform him that I was speaking at that moment to his star witness Trina Trix. That's the salient point. Not that Sly Fulgoni has a phone up there, but that he knows the moves we're making. What's your next question? She checked her notes before asking it.
Well, before yesterday we had two separate things going. We had the Lacoste case, and then we had this other thing with Moya that we thought was separate but might be useful to bring in as part of a possible straw man defense for Lacoste. But now, if I'm following you correctly, we're talking about these two things being one case.
I nodded. Yes, that's what I'm saying. This is all one case now. What links it for us is obviously Gloria Dayton. But the key thing here is Lankford. He was following Gloria the night of the murder.
So Lacoste, he was set up all along, Earl said.
I nodded again. Right.
And this isn't just an angle we're playing or a strategy, Jennifer said. We're saying this is now our case.
Right again. I looked around. Three walls of the boardroom were glass, but there was one wall of old Chicago brick. Lorna, we need a whiteboard for that wall. I wish we could diagram this. It would make it easier.
I'll get one, Lorna said.
And get the locks changed on this place. Also, I want two cameras, one on the door, one on this room. When we go to trial, this is going to be ground zero, and I want it safe and secure.
I can put a guy on the place, 24/7, Sisko said. Might be worth it.
And what money do we use to pay for all this? Lorna asked.
Hold off on the guy, Sisko, I said. Maybe when we get to trial. For now, we'll go with just locks and cameras. I then leaned forward, elbows on the table. It's all one case now, I said again. And so we need to take it apart and look at all of the pieces. 8 years ago, I was manipulated. I handled a case and made moves I believed were of my own design. But they weren't. And I'm not going to let that happen again here. I sat back and waited for comment, but I got only silent stares. I saw Sisko look over my shoulder and through the glass door behind me. He started to get up. I turned around. Across the loft, there was a man standing by the front door. He was actually bigger than Sisko. One of my guys, Sisko said as he left the boardroom. I turned and looked back at the others. If this was a movie, that guy's name would be Tiny. The others laughed. I got up to refill my coffee, and by the time I returned, Sisko was coming back to the boardroom.
I stayed standing and awaited the verdict. Sisko poked his head through the door but didn't come in.
The Lincoln's been jacked, he said. Do you want them to take it out? We could find a place for it. Maybe a FedEx truck would be good. Keep them running around.
By jacked, he meant low-jacked, a reference to an anti-theft tracking system. But in this case, he was telling me somebody had crawled underneath my car and attached a GPS tracker.
What does that mean? Aronson asked.
While Sisko explained what I already knew, I thought about the question of whether to remove the device or leave it in place and possibly find a way of making it work to my advantage against whoever was monitoring my movements. A FedEx truck would keep them running in circles, but it would also tip our hand and let them know we were onto them. Leave it in place, I said when Sisko finished his explanation to the others. For now, at least. It might come in handy.
Keep in mind it could be just a backup, Sisko cautioned. You still could have a live tail. I'll keep the Indians up on the cliffs a couple days, just to see.
Sounds good. He turned in the doorway and signaled to his man with a flat hand, as if running it along the surface of a table. Status quo, leave the tracker in place. The man pointed at Sisko, message understood, and walked through the door. Sisko returned to the table, pointing to the Paquin 7000 as he went.
Sorry, he couldn't get a call into me because of the blocker. I nodded.
What's that guy's name? I asked.
Who, little guy? I actually don't know his real name. I just know him as Little Guy.
I snapped my fingers. I'd been close. The others muffled their laughter, and Sisko looked at all of us like he knew there was some kind of joke, and it was on him.
Are there any bikers out there who don't have nicknames? Jennifer asked.
Oh, you mean a nickname like Bullocks? No, I don't think there are, to tell you the truth.
There was more laughter, and then I turned it serious again.
Okay, let's look at this thing. We now know what's on the surface. Let's go below. First off, there's the question why. Why the manipulation 8 years ago? If we believe what we have been told, then Marco goes to Gloria and tells her to plant a gun in Moya's hotel room so that when he gets busted, he gets the firearms enhancement, making him eligible for a life sentence. Okay, we get that. But then comes the hard part.
Why didn't Marco just bust him once the gun was in place? Sisko asked.
I pointed at him. Exactly. Instead of the easy and direct route, he sets forth a strategy in which Gloria allows herself to get busted by the locals and then comes to me. She drops enough information on me for my eyes to light up and think there is a deal to be made. I go see the DA and make that deal. Moya gets busted, the gun is found, and the rest is history. It still begs the question, why go to all that trouble? There was a pause, while my team considered the complicated setup. Jennifer was the first to dive in.
Marco couldn't be seen as attached to it, she said. For some reason, he had to be removed from this and wait until it was brought to him. The DA makes the deal with you. The LAPD gets the bust, but then Marco jumps in with the outstanding federal warrant that trumps everything. It looks like it just fell into his lap, but he orchestrated the whole thing.
Which only brings us back to why, Sisko said.
Exactly, I said.
Do you think Marco knew Moya and didn't want him to know he'd set it up? Jennifer asked. So he sort of hid behind Gloria and you?
Maybe, I said. But he still eventually got the case.
What if it was because of Moya? Sisko said. He's a cartel guy, and they're the most violent people on the planet. They'll wipe out a whole village just to make sure they get one informant. Maybe Marco didn't want to draw the target on himself for bringing Moya down. This way he just sat back, and the case came to him all signed, sealed, and delivered. If Moya started looking for somebody to come down on, it would stop with Gloria.
That's possible, I guess, I said. But then if Moya was looking for revenge, why did he wait 7 years to hit Gloria?
Sisko shook his head, unconvinced by either argument. That was the trouble with spitballing ideas. More often than not, you found yourself talked into a logic corner.
Maybe we're talking about two separate things, Jennifer said. Two things separated by 7 years. You have the bust and the unknown reason for how Marco set it up, and then you have Gloria's murder, which may have happened for an entirely different reason.
You're back to thinking our client did it, I said.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm pretty convinced he's a patsy in this. I'm just saying 7 years is a long time. Things change. You yourself just asked why Moya would wait 7 years to exact vengeance. I don't think he did. Gloria's death is a big loss to him. His habeas suit claims the gun was planted in his hotel room, so he needed Gloria to make his case. Who's he got now? Trina Trix and her second-hand account? Good luck putting her before the U.S. District Court of Appeals.
I stared at Jennifer for a long moment and slowly started to nod. Out of the mouth of babes, I said. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way. I'm saying you're the rookie here, and I think you just nailed something. Moya needed her alive for the habeas, to tell the court what she did.
Well, maybe she wouldn't tell the truth, and so he had her whacked, Sisko said, nodding afterward to help convince himself.
I shook my head. I didn't like it. Something was missing.
If we start with Moya needing her alive, Jennifer said, the question becomes who needed her dead.
I nodded now, liking this logic. I waited a moment, spreading my hands to the others for the obvious answer. None came. Marco, I said. I leaned back in my chair and looked from Sisko to Jennifer. They stared back blankly.
What, am I the only one seeing this? I asked.
So you're choosing a federal agent over a cartel thug as our straw man? Jennifer asked. That doesn't sound like a good strategy.
It's no longer a straw man defense if it is a true defense, I said. Doesn't matter if it's a tough sell if it's what really happened.
There was a silence as my words were considered, and then Jennifer broke it.
But why? Why would Marco want her dead? She asked. I shrugged. That's what we have to find out, I said. Lots of money and drugs, Earl said. It bends a lot of people. I pointed at him like he was a genius. Right there, I said. If we believe the story that Marco made Gloria plant the gun, then we're dealing with a rogue agent already. We don't know if he breaks the rules to get bad guys or if it's to protect something else. Either way, is it that far a leap to think he might kill to protect himself and whatever his rogue operation is? If Gloria became a danger to him, then I think she was definitely in the crosshairs. I leaned forward. So this is what we need to do. We need to find out more about Marco and this group he's in, the ICE team. Find out what other cases they've made before and since Moya. See what kind of reputation they have. We look at other cases to see if anything at all looks bent.
I'll search his name through court records, Jennifer said. State and federal. Pull out everything I can find and start from there.
I'll ask around, Sisko added. I know some people who know some people.
And I'll take the Fulgoni boys, I said. And Mr. Moya. They might now actually be assets to our case.
I could feel the stirring of adrenaline in my veins. Nothing like having a sense of direction to get the blood moving.
Do you think this means it was the DEA who jacked your car? Jennifer asked. And not Moya or Fulgoni?
The thought of a rogue DEA agent monitoring my moves froze the adrenaline into tiny icicles in my veins. If that's the case, then Fulgoni calling Trina last night when I was there was just coincidence, I said. Not sure I believe that. It was one of the conundrums of the case that would need to be cleared up before we had full understanding. Jennifer gathered up her notepad and files and started to push back her chair. Wait a minute, I said. We're not finished.
She resettled and looked at me.
Lankford, I said.
He was tailing Gloria the night she was murdered. If we're looking at Marco, then we have to look for a connection between him and Lankford. We find that, and we'll be close to having everything we need.
I turned my attention to Sisko.
Everything you can find on him, I said. If he knows Marco, I want to know from where. I want to know how.
On it, Sisko said.
I looked back at Jennifer. Just because we're looking at Marco doesn't mean we take our eyes off Moya. We have to know everything there is to know about his case. It will help us understand Marco. I still want you on that.
Got it.
Now I turn to Lorna and Earl. Lorna, you keep the boat floating, and Earl, you're with me.
I think that's it, everybody. For now, at least.
Be careful out there. Remember who we're dealing with.
Everybody started to get up. They were all silent as they moved.
It hadn't been the kind of meeting that drew any kind of lasting jocularity or camaraderie out of the troops. We were going off in separate directions to conduct a sub rosa investigation of a possibly dangerous federal agent.
There weren't too many things more sobering to consider than that.
Chapter 19. On the way downtown, I had to tell Earl to cool it with a single-handed effort to determine if we had a tail. He was weaving in and out of traffic, accelerating and then braking, moving into exit lanes, and then jerking the wheel to pull out at the last moment and get back on the freeway.
Let Sisko handle that, I said. You just get me down to the courthouse in one piece.
Sorry, boss, I got carried away. But I gotta say, I like all this stuff, you know, being in the meeting and knowing what's going on.
Well, like I said, when things happen and I need your help, like yesterday, for example, I'll bring you into it.
That's cool.
He settled down after that, and we made it downtown without incident. I had Earl drop me at the criminal courts building. I told him I didn't know how long I would be. I had no business in court, but the district attorney's office was up on the 16th floor, and I was headed there. After getting out, I looked over the roof of the car and casually scanned the intersection of Temple and Spring. I didn't see anything or anyone out of the ordinary. I did catch myself checking the roof lines for Indians, however. I didn't see anything up there either. After I made it through the metal detector, I took one of the crowded elevators up to 16. I had no appointment and knew I might be in for a nice long wait on a hard plastic chair, but I thought I needed to take a shot at getting in to see Leslie Fair. She had been a key player in the occurrences of 8 years before, yet she had barely come up for discussion lately. She had been the deputy DA who made the deal that resulted in Hector Aronde Moya's arrest and Gloria Dayton's freedom. Leslie had done well for herself in the years since that deal was struck. She won a few big trials and chose correctly in throwing her support to my opponent, Damon Kennedy, in the election. That paid off with a major promotion. She was now a head deputy DA and was in charge of the major trials unit. This made her more of a manager of trial attorneys and court schedules, so it was rare to see her standing for the people anymore. This, of course, was fine by me. She was a tough prosecutor, and I was glad I didn't need to worry about crossing paths with her again in court. I counted the Gloria Dayton case as the only victory I ever scored against her. Of course, it was a hollow victory in my eyes now. I may have disliked facing Leslie Fair on cases, but I respected her. And now, I thought she should know what had happened to Gloria Dayton. Maybe the news would make her inclined to help me fill in some of the details from 8 years before. I want